Wait, and who? I hurried ahead, my feet unsteady.
Buffalo, she called behind me. Buffalo.
I waved without looking back. Never again, no more, no more, I went on. At Fifth, a cab passed and I tried to hail it, only to hear someone's voice arise, the sound floating gaily by. I looked up the lighted avenue for another, hearing suddenly the screech of brakes and turning to see the cab stop and a white arm beckoning. The cab reversed, rolled close, settling with a bounce. I laughed. It was Sybil. I stumbled forward, came to the door. She smiled out at me, her head framed in the window, still pulling to one side, her hair waving down.
Get in, beautiful, and take me to Harlem.
I shook my head, feeling it heavy and sad. No, I said, I've got work to do, Sybil. You better go home.
No, beautiful. Take me with you.
I turned to the driver, my hand upon the door. He was small, dark-haired, and disapproving, a glint of red from the traffic light coloring the tip of his nose. I gave him the address and my last $5 bill. He took it, glumly disapproving.
No, beautiful, she said. I want to go to Harlem, be with you.
Good night, I said, stepping back from the curb. We were in the middle of the block, and I saw them pull away.
No, she said, no, Boofoo, don't leave.
Her face wild-eyed and white showed in the door. I stood there watching him plunge swiftly and contemptuously out of sight, his taillight as red as his nose. I walked with eyes closed, seeming to float and trying to clear my head, then opened them and crossed to the parkside along the cobbles. High above, the cars sailed round and round the drive, their headlights stabbing. All the taxis were hired, all going downtown. Center of gravity. I plodded on, my head a whirl. Then near 110th Street, I saw her again. She was waiting beneath a street lamp, waving. I wasn't surprised. I had become fatalistic. I came up slowly, hearing her laugh. She was ahead of me and beginning to run, barefoot, loosely, as in a dream, running. Unsteadily, but swift, and me surprised and unable to catch up, lead-legged, seeing her ahead and calling, Sybil! Sybil! Running lead-legged along the parkside.
Come on, Boofle, she called, looking back and stumbling. Catch Sybil! Sybil!
Running barefoot and girdleless along the park. I ran, the briefcase heavy beneath my arm. Something told me I had to get to the office. Sybil, wait, I called. She ran, the colors of her dress flaring flame-like in the bright places of the dark, a rustling motion, legs working awkwardly beneath her, and white heels flashing, her skirts held high. Let her go, I thought. But now she was crossing the street and running wildly, only to go down at the curb and standing and going down again with a bumped backside, completely unsteady, now that her momentum was gone.
"Boofoo," she said as I came up. "Damn, Boofoo, you push me?"
"Get up," I said without anger. "Get up." Taking her soft arm, she stood, her arms flung wide for an embrace. "No," I said, "this isn't Thursday. I've got to get there. What do they plan for me, Sybil?"
"Who, Boofoo?"
"Jack and George, Tobin and all."
"You ran me down, Boofoo," she said. "Forget them, bunch of dead heads." Unhipped, you know. We didn't make this stinking world, Boofle. Forget!
I saw the taxi just in time, approaching swiftly from the corner, a double-decker bus looming two blocks behind. The cabbie looked over, his head out of the window, sitting high at the wheel as he made a swift U-turn and came alongside. His face was shocked, disbelieving. Come now, Sybil, I said, and no tricks.
Pardon me, old man, the driver said, his voice concerned, but you're not taking her up in Harlem, are you?
No, the lady's going downtown, I said. Get in, Sybil.
Boofle's an old dictator,
she said to the driver, who looked at me silently as though I were mad. A game stud, he muttered. A most game stud. But she got in.
Just an old dictator, Boofle.
Look, I told him, take her straight home and don't let her get out of the cab. I don't want her running around Harlem. She's precious, a great lady.
Sure, man, I don't blame you, he said. Things is popping up there.
The cab was already rolling as I yelled, What's going on?
They're taking the joint apart, he called above the shifting of the gears.
I watched them go and made for the bus stop. This time I'll make sure, I thought, stepping out and flagging the bus and getting on. If she comes back, she'll find me gone. And I knew stronger than ever that I should hurry, but I was still too foggy in my mind. Couldn't get myself together. I sat gripping my briefcase, my eyes closed, feeling the bus sailing swift beneath me. Soon it would turn up 7th Avenue. Sybil, forgive me, I thought. The bus rolled. But when I opened my eyes, we were turning into Riverside Drive. This, too, I accepted calmly. The whole night was out of joint. I'd had too many drinks. Time ran fluid, invisible, sad. Looking out, I could see a ship moving upstream, its running lights bright points in the night. The cool sea smell came through to me, constant and thick in the swiftly unfolding blur of anchored boats, dark water and lights pouring past. Across the river was Jersey, and I remembered my entry into Harlem. Long past, I thought. Long past. It was as if drowned in the river. To my right and ahead, the church spire towered high, crowned with a red light of warning. And now we were passing the hero's tomb, and I recalled a visit there. You went up the steps and inside, and you looked far below to find him at rest. Draped flags. 125th Street came quickly. I stumbled off, hearing the bus pull away as I faced the water. There was a light breeze, but now, with the motion gone, the heat returned, clinging. Far ahead in the dark, I saw the monumental bridge, ropes of lights across the dark river, and closer, high above the shoreline, the Palisades, their revolutionary agony lost in the riotous lights of roller coasters. "The time is now," the sign across the river began. But with history stomping upon me with hobnailed boots, I thought with a laugh, why worry about time? I crossed the street to the drinking fountain, feeling the water cooling going down, then dampened a handkerchief and swabbed my face, eyes. The water flashed, gurgled, sprayed. I pressed forward my face, feeling wet, cool, hearing the infant joy of fountains. Then heard the other sound. It was not the river nor the curving cars that flashed through the dark, but pitched like a distant crowd or a swift river at flood tide. I moved forward, found the steps, and started down. Below the bridge lay the hard stone river of the street, and for a second I looked at the waves of cobblestones as though I expected water, as though the fountain above had drawn from them. Still I would enter and go across to Harlem. Below the steps the trolley rails gleamed steely. I hurried, the sound drawing closer. Myriad-voiced, humming, enfolding me, numbing the air as I started beneath the ramp. It came, a twitter, a coo, a subdued roar that seemed trying to tell me something, give me some message. I stopped, looking around me. The girders marched off rhythmically into the dark. Over the cobblestones, the red lights shone. Then I was beneath the bridge, and it was as though they had been waiting for me, and no one but me, dedicated and set aside for me for an eternity. And I looked above toward the sound, my mind forming an image of wings as something struck my face and streaked. I could smell the foul air now and see the encrusted barrage, feeling it streak my jacket and raising my briefcase above my head and running, hearing it splattering around, falling like rain. I ran the gauntlet, thinking even the birds, even the pigeons and the sparrows and the goddamn gulls. I ran blindly, boiling with outrage and despair and harsh laughter, running from the birds to what? I didn't know. I ran. Why was I here at all? I ran through the night, ran within myself, ran. When I reached Morningside, the shooting sounded like a distant celebration of the 4th of July, and I hurried forward. At St. Nicholas, the streetlights were out. A thunderous sound arose, and I saw four men running toward me, pushing something that jarred the walk. It was a safe. "Say," I began, "get the hell out the way." I leaped aside into the street, and there was a sudden and brilliant suspension of time, like the interval between the last axe stroke and the felling of a tall tree, in which there had been a loud noise followed by a loud silence. Then I was aware of figures crouching in doorways and along the curb. Then time burst and I was down in the street, conscious but unable to rise, struggling against the street and seeing the flashes as the guns went off back at the corner of the avenue, aware, To my left of the men still speeding the rumbling safe along the walk is back up the street behind me, two policemen almost invisible in black shirts thrust flaming pistols before them. One of the safe rollers pitched forward and farther away, past the corner, a bullet struck an auto tire, the released air shrieking like a huge animal in agony. I rolled, flopping around, willing myself to crawl closer to the curb, but unable, feeling a sudden wet warmth upon my face and seeing the safe shooting wildly into the intersection and the men rounding the corner into the dark, pounding, gone, gone now, as the skittering safe bounded off at a tangent, shot into the intersection and lodged in the third rail and sent up a curtain of sparks that lit up the block like a blue dream, a dream I was dreaming and through which I could see the cops braced on a target range, feet forward, free arms akimbo, firing with deliberate aim. "Get hold of emergency," one of them called, and I saw them turn and disappear where the dull glint of trolley rails faded off into the dark. Suddenly the block leaped alive. Men who seemed to rise up out of the sidewalks were rushing into the storefronts above me, their voices rising excitedly, and now the blood was in my face and I could move, getting to my knees as someone out of the crowd was helping me to stand. "You heard Daddy?"
Some. I don't know. I couldn't quite see them.
"Damn! He's got a hole in his head," a voice said. A light flashed in my face, came closer. I felt a hard hand upon my skull and moved away. "Hell, it's just a nick," a voice said. "One of them 45s hit your little finger, you got to go down." "Well, this one over here's going down for the last time," someone called from the walk. "They got him clean."
I wiped my face, my head ringing. Something was missing.
"Here, buddy, this yours?"
It was my briefcase, extended to me by its handles. I seized it with sudden panic, as though something infinitely precious had almost been lost to me. "Thanks," I said, peering into their dim, blue-tinted features. I looked at the dead man. He lay face forward, the crowd working around him. I realized suddenly that it might have been me huddled there, feeling, too, that I had seen him there before, in the bright light of noon, long ago. How long? Knew his name, I thought, and suddenly my knees flowed forward. I sat there, my fist that gripped the briefcase, bruising against the street. My head slumped forward. They were going around me.
"Get off my foot, man," I heard. "Quit shoving. There's plenty for everybody."
There was something I had to do, and I knew that my forgetfulness wasn't real, as one knows that the forgotten details of certain dreams are not truly forgotten, but evaded. I knew, and in my mind I was trying to reach through the gray veil that now seemed to hang behind my eyes as opaquely as the blue curtain that screened the street beyond the safe. The dizziness left, and I managed to stand, holding on to my briefcase, pressing a handkerchief to my head. Up the street there sounded the crashing of huge sheets of glass, and through the blue mysteriousness of the dark, the walks shimmered like shattered mirrors. All the street signs were dead. All the day sounds had lost their stable meaning. Somewhere a burglar alarm went off, a meaningless, blangy sound, followed by the joyful shouts of looters.
"Come on," someone called nearby. "Let's go, buddy,"
the man who helped me said. He took my arm, a thin man who carried a large cloth bag slung over his shoulder.
"The shape you in wouldn't do to leave you around here," he said. "You act like you drunk."
"Go where?" I said.
"Where? Hell, man, everywhere. We get to moving, no telling where we might go. Hey, Dupree,"
he called.
"Hey, say, man, goddamn, don't be calling my name so loud," a voice answered. "Here I am over here, get me some work shirts."
"Get some for me, Dupree," he said.
"All right, but don't think I'm your papa,"
the answer came. I looked at the thin man, feeling a surge of friendship. He didn't know me. His help was disinterested.
"Hey, Dupree," he called. "We gonna do it?"
"Hell yes, soon as I get me these shirts."
The crowd was working in and out of the stores like ants around spilled sugar. From time to time there came the crash of glass shots, fire trucks in distant streets.
"How you feeling, man?" the man said.
"Still fuzzy," I said, "and weak."
"Let's see if it stopped bleeding."
"Yeah, you'll be all right."
I saw him vaguely, though his voice came clear.
"Sure," I said. "Man, you lucky you ain't dead. These sons of bitches is really shooting now," he said. "Over on Lennox, they was aiming up in the air. If I could find me a rifle, I'd show 'em. Here, take you a drink of this good scotch," he said, taking a quart bottle from his hip pocket. "I got me a whole case stash what I got from a liquor store over there.
Over there, all you got to do is breathe. And you gunk, man, drunk, 100-proof bonded whiskey flowing all in the gutters.
I took a drink, shuddering as the whiskey went down, but thankful for the shock it gave me. There was a bursting, tearing movement of people around me, dark figures in a blue glow.
"Look at him take it away," he said, looking into the dark action of the crowd. "Me, I'm tired. Was you over on Lennox?"
"No," I said, seeing a woman moving slowly past with a row of about a dozen dressed chickens suspended by their necks from the handle of a new straw broom.
"Hell, you ought to see it, man. Everything is tore up. By now, the women's is picking it clean. I saw one old woman with a whole side of a cow on her back, man. She was about bent bow-legged trying to make it home." "Here come Dupree now," he said, breaking off.
I saw a little hard man come out of the crowd carrying several boxes. He wore three hats upon his head, and several pairs of suspenders flopped about his shoulders. And now as he came toward us, I saw that he wore a pair of gleaming new rubber hip boots. His pockets bulged, and over his shoulder he carried a cloth sack that swung heavily behind him.
"Damn, Dupree," my friend said, pointing to his head. "You got one of them for me? What kind is they?"
Dupree stopped and looked at him.
"With all them hats in there, I'm gonna come out with anything but a Dobbs. Man, are you mad? All them new, pretty, colored Dobbs? Come on, let's get going before the cops get back. Damn, look at that thing blaze."
I looked toward the curtain of blue fire through which vague figures toiled. Dupree called out and several men left the crowd and joined us in the street. We moved off, my friend, Schofield, the others called him, leading me along. My head throbbed, still bled.
"Look like you got some loot, too," he said, pointing to my briefcase.
"Not much," I said, thinking, "loot? Loot?" And suddenly I knew why it was heavy, remembering Mary's broken bank and the coins. And now I found myself opening the briefcase and dropping all my papers, my Brotherhood identification, the anonymous letter along with Clifton's doll, into it.
"Fill it up, man. Don't you be bashful. You wait till we tackle one of these pawn shops. That dude's got him a cotton-picking sack full of stuff. He could go into business."
"Well, I'll be damned," a man on the other side of me said. "I thought that was a cotton sack. Where'd he get that thing?"
"He brought it with him when he came north," Schofield said. "Dude swears that when he goes back, he'll have it full of $10 bills. Hell, after tonight, he'll need him a warehouse for all the stuff he's got. You fill that briefcase, buddy. Get yourself something."
"No," I said. I've enough in it already. And now I remembered very clearly where I'd started out for, but could not leave them.
"Maybe you're right," Schofield said. "How I know, you might have it full of diamonds or something. Man oughtn't be too greedy, though it's time something like this happened."
We moved along. Should I leave? Get on to the district? Where were they, at the birthday celebration? "How'd all this get started?" I said. Schofield seemed surprised.
"Damn, if I know, man. A cop shot a woman or something."
Another man moved close to us as somewhere a piece of heavy steel rang down.
"Hell, that wasn't what started it," he said. "It was that fellow. What's his name?"
"Who?" I said. "What's his name?"
"That young guy. You know, everybody's mad about."
Clifton, I thought. It's for Clifton. A night for Clifton.
"Oh, man, don't tell me," Schofield said. "Didn't I see it with my own eyes? About 8 o'clock down on Lennox and 123rd, this Patty slapped a kid for grabbing a baby Ruth, and the kid's mama took it up. And then the Patty slapped her. And that's when all hell broke loose."
"You were there?" I said.
"Same as I'm here. Some fellow said the kid made the Patty mad by grabbing a candy named after a white woman." "Damn if that's the way I heard it,"
another man said.
"When I come up, they said a white woman set it off by trying to take a black gal's man."
"Damn who started it," Dupree said. "All I want is for it to last a while."
"It was a white gal, all right, but that wasn't the way it was. She was drunk," another voice said.
But it couldn't have been Sybil, I thought. It had already started.
"You want to know who started it?"
A man holding a pair of binoculars called from the window of a pawn shop.
"You want really know?"
"Sure," I said.
"Well, you don't need to go no further. It was started by that great leader, Ross the Destroyer."
"That monkey chaser," someone said.
"Listen, bastard. Don't nobody know how it started," Dupree said.
"Somebody has to know," I said. Schofield held his whiskey toward me. I refused it.
"Hell, man, it just exploded. These is dog days," he said. Dog days. Show, this hot weather. I tell you, they mad over what happened to that young fella. What's his name?
We were passing a building now, and I heard a voice calling frantically,
Colored Stove! Colored Stove! Then put up a sign, mother fowler, a voice said. You probably rotten as the others. Listen to that bastard. For one time in his life, he's glad to be colored, Schofield said.
Colored Stove!
The voice went on automatically.
Hey, you sure you ain't got some white blood?
No, sir,
the voice said.
Should I bust him, man? For what? He ain't got a damn thing. Let the mother fowler alone.
A few doors away, we came to a hardware store.
This is the first stop, men, Dupree said.
What happens now? I said.
Who are you?
He said, cocking his thrice-hatted head. Nobody, just one of the boys, I began.
You sure you ain't somebody I know?
I'm pretty sure, I said.
He's all right, dude,
Schofield said.
Them cops shot him.
Dupree looked at me and kicked something, a pound of butter sending it smearing across the hot street.
We fixin' to do something what needs to be done, he said. First we gets a flashlight for everybody. And let's have some organization, y'all. Don't everybody be running over everybody else. Come on.
Come on in, buddy,
Schofield said. I felt no need to lead or leave them. Was glad to follow. Was gripped by a need to see where and to what they would lead. And all the time the thought that I should go to the district was with me. We went inside the store, into the dark, glinting with metal. They moved carefully, and I could hear them searching, sweeping objects to the floor. The cash register rang.
Here's some flashlights over here,
someone called.
How many? Dupree said.
Plenty, man.
Okay, pass out one to everybody. They got batteries?
No, but there's plenty of them, too, about a dozen boxes.
Okay, give me one with batteries so I can find the buckets. Then every man get him a light.
Here's some buckets over here,
Schofield said.
Then all we got to find is where he keeps the oil.
Oil? I said.
Coal oil, man. And hey, y'all, he called. Don't nobody be smoking in here.
I stood beside Schofield listening to the noise as he took a stack of zinc buckets and passed them out. Now the store leaped alive with flashing lights and flickering shadows.
Keep them lights down on the floor, Dupree called. No use letting folks see who we are. Now, when you get your buckets, line up and let me fill them.
Listen, old dude, lay it down. He's a bitch, ain't he, buddy? He always liked to lead things, and he's always leading me into trouble.
What are we getting ready to do, I said.
You'll see, Dupree said. Hey, you, over there. Come on from behind that counter and take this bucket. Don't you see ain't nothing in that cash register that if it was, I'd have it myself?
Suddenly, the banging of buckets ceased. We moved into the back room. By the light of a flash, I could see a row of fuel drums mounted on racks. Dupree stood before them in his new hip boots and filled each bucket with oil. We moved in slow order. Our buckets filled, we filed out into the street. I stood there in the dark, feeling a rising excitement as their voices played around me. What was the meaning of it all? What should I think of it? Do about it?
With this stuff, Dupree said, we better walk in the middle of the street. It's just down around the corner.
Then as we moved off, a group of boys ran among us, and the men started using their lights, revealing darting figures in blonde wigs, the tails of their stolen dress coats flying. Behind them, in hot pursuit, came a gang armed with dummy rifles taken from an Army and Navy store. I laughed with the others, thinking, a holy holiday for Clifton.
Put out them lights, Dupree commanded.
Behind us came the sound of screams, laughter. Ahead, the footfalls of the running boys, distant fire trucks shooting, and in the quiet intervals, the steady filtering of shattered glass. I could smell the kerosene as it sloshed from the buckets and slapped against the street. Suddenly, Schofield grabbed my arm.
Good God, look yonder!
And I saw a crowd of men running up, pulling a Borden's milk wagon, on top of which, surrounded by a row of railroad flares, a huge woman in a gingham pinafore sat drinking beer from a barrel which sat before her. The men would run furiously a few paces and stop, resting between the shafts, run a few paces and rest, shouting and laughing and drinking from a jug, as she on top threw back her head and shouted passionately in a full-throated voice of blues singer's timbre, If it hadn't been for the referee, Joe Louis would have killed Jim Jeffery free beer, sloshing the dipper of beer around. We stepped aside, amazed, as she bowed graciously from side to side like a tipsy fat lady in a circus parade, the dipper like a gravy spoon in her enormous hand. Then she laughed and drank deeply while reaching over nonchalantly with her free hand to send quart after quart of milk crashing into the street, and all the time the men running with the wagon over the debris. Around me there were shouts of laughter and disapproval.
"Somebody better stop them fools," Schofield said in outrage. "That's what I call taking things too far. God damn, how the hell they gonna get her down from there after she gets full of beer? Somebody answer me that. How they gonna get her down? Round here throwing away all that good milk."
The big woman left me unnerved. Milk and beer. I felt sad, watching the wagon careen dangerously as they went around a corner. We went on, avoiding the broken bottles as now the spilling kerosene splashed into the pale, spilt milk. How much has happened? Why was I torn? We moved around a corner. My head still ached. Schofield touched my arm.
"Here we is," he said.
We had come to a huge tenement building. Where are we?" I said.
"It's the place where most of us live," he said. "Come on."
So that was it, the meaning of the kerosene. I couldn't believe it, couldn't believe they had the nerve. All the windows seemed empty. They blacked it out themselves. I saw now only by flash or flame. "Where will you live?" I said, looking up, up.
"You call this living?" Schofield said. "It's the only way to get rid of it, man."
I looked for hesitation in their vague forms. They stood looking at the building rising above us, the liquid dark of the oil simmering dully in the stray flecks of light that struck their pails. Bent forward, their shoulders bowed. None said no by word or stance, and in the dark windows and on the roofs above I could now discern the forms of women and children. Dupree moved toward the building.
"Now look at here, y'all," he said, his triple-hatted head showing grotesquely atop the stoop. "I wants all the women and children and the old and the sick folks brought out. And when you takes your buckets up the stairs, I wants you to go clean to the top. I mean the top. And when you get there, I want you to start using your flashlights in every room and make sure nobody gets left behind. Then when you get them out, start splashing coal oil. Then when you get it splashed, I'm going to holler. And when I holler 3 times, I want you to light them matches and get. After that, it's every tub on its own black bottom."
It didn't occur to me to interfere or to question. They had a plan. Already I could see the women and children coming down the steps. A child was crying, and suddenly everyone paused, turning, looking off into the dark. Somewhere nearby, an incongruous sound shook the dark, an air hammer pounding like a machine gun. They paused with the sensitivity of grazing deer, then returned to their work, the women and children once more moving.
"That's right, y'all. You ladies move on up the street to the folks you're gonna stay with," Dupree said, "and keep holt them kids."
Someone pounded my back and I swung around, seeing a woman push past me and climb up to catch Dupree's arm, the two figures seeming to blend as her voice rose, vibrant and desperate.
"Please, Dupree," she said, "please. You know my time's almost here. You know it is. If you do it now, where I'm gonna go to?"
Dupree pulled away and rose to a higher step. He looked down at her, shaking his thrice-hatted head.
"Now get on out the way, Lottie," he said patiently. "Why you have to start this now? We're dumping all over it, and you know I ain't gonna change. And listen here, the rest of y'all," he said, reaching into the top of his hip boot and producing a nickel-plated revolver and waving it around. "Don't think there's gonna be any mind-changing either, and I don't aim for no arguments, neither." "You goddamn right, Dupree. We with you. My kid died from the TBs in that death trap, but I bet a man ain't no more gonna be born in there," he said. "So now, Lottie, you go on up the street and let us men get going."
She stood back, crying. I looked at her, in house shoes, her breasts turgid, her belly heavy and high. In the crowd, women's hands took her away. Her large, liquid eyes turned for a second toward the man in the rubber boots. What type of man is he? What would Jack say of him? Jack! Jack! And where was he in this?
"Let's go, buddy,"
Schofield said, nudging me. I followed him, filled with a sense of Jack's outrageous unreality. We went in, up the stairs, flashing our lights. Ahead, I saw Dupree moving. He
was a type of man nothing in my life had taught me to see, to understand, or respect. A man outside the scheme till now. We entered rooms littered with the signs of swift emptying. It was hot, close.
"This here's my own apartment," Schofield said, "and ain't the bedbugs gonna get a surprise?"
We slapped the kerosene about upon an old mattress along the floor, then moved into the hall using the flashlights. From all through the building came the sounds of footsteps, of splashing oil, the occasional prayerful protest of some old one being forced to leave. The men worked in silence now, like moles deep in the earth. Time seemed to hold. No one laughed. Then from below came Dupree's voice.
"Okay, mens. We got everybody out. Now, starting with the top floor, I want you to start striking matches. Be careful and don't set yourself on fire."
There was still some kerosene left in Schofield's bucket, and I saw him pick up a rag and drop it in. Then came the sputtering of a match, and I saw the room leap to flame. The heat flared up, and I backed away. He stood there silhouetted against the red flare, looking into the flame, shouting,
"God damn you rotten sons of bitches! You didn't think I'd do it, but here it is! You wouldn't fix it up? Now, see how you like it!"
"Let's go," I said. Below us, men shot downstairs, 5 and 6 steps at a time, moving in the weird light of flash and flame and long dream bounds. On each floor as I passed, smoke and flame arose, and now I was seized with a fierce sense of exultation. They've done it, I thought. They organized it and carried it through, alone, the decision, their own, and their own action, capable of their own action. There came a thunder of footfalls above me, someone calling,
"Keep going, man. It's hell upstairs. Somebody done opened the door to the roof and them flames is leaping. Come on,"
Schofield said. I moved, feeling something slip, and was halfway down the next flight before realizing that my briefcase was gone. For a second, I hesitated, but I'd had it too long to leave it now.
"Come on, buddy," Schofield called. "We can't be fooling around."
"In a second," I said. Men were shooting past. I bent over, holding onto the handrail, and shouldered my way back up the stairs, using my flash along each step, back slowly, finding it, an oily footstep embedded with crushed pieces of plaster showing upon its leather side. Getting it now, and turning to bound down again. The oil won't come off easily, I thought with a pang, but this was it. What I had known was coming around the dark corner of my mind, had known and tried to tell the committee, and which they had ignored. I plunged down, shaking with fierce excitement. At the landing, I saw a bucket full of kerosene and seized it, flinging it impulsively into a burning room. A huge puff of smoke-fringed flame filled the doorway, licking outward toward me. I ran, choking and coughing as I plunged. They did it themselves, I thought, holding my breath. Planned it, organized it, applied the flame. I burst into the air and the exploding sounds of the night, and I did not know if the voice was that of a man, woman, or child, but for a moment I stood on the stoop with the red doorway behind me and heard the voice call me by my brotherhood name. It was as though I had been aroused from sleep, and for an instant I stood there looking, listening to the voice, almost lost in the clamor of shouts, screams, burglar alarms, and sirens.
"Brother, ain't it wonderful?" it called. "You said you would lead us. You really said it."
I went down into the street, going slowly but filled with a feverish inner need to be away from that voice. Where had Schofield gone? Most of their eyes, white in the flame-flushed dark, looked toward the building. But now I heard someone say,
"Woman, who you say that is?"
And she proudly repeated my name.
"Where you go? Get him, man! Ross want him!"
I went into the crowd, walking slowly, smoothly into the dark crowd, the whole surface of my skin alert, my back chilled, looking, listening to those moving with a heaving and sweating and a burr of talk around me, and aware that now I wanted to see them, needed to see them. I could not. Feeling them, a dark mass in motion on a dark night, a black river ripping through a black land, and Ross or Tarp could move beside me and I wouldn't know. I was one with the mass, moving down the littered street over the puddles of oil and milk, my personality blasted. Then I was in the next block, dodging in and out, hearing them somewhere in the crowd behind me, moving on through the sound of sirens and burglar alarms to be swept into a swifter crowd and pushed along, half running, half walking, trying to see behind me and wondering where the others had gone.
There was shooting back there now, and on the other side of me, throwing garbage cans, bricks, and pieces of metal into plate glass windows. I moved, feeling as though a huge force was on the point of bursting. Shouldering my way to the side, I stood in a doorway and watched them move, feeling a certain vindication as I thought of the message that had brought me here. Who had called? One of the district members or someone from Jack's birthday celebration? Who wanted me at the district after it was too late? Very well. I'd go there, now. I'd see what the masterminds thought now. Where were they anyway, and what profound conclusions were they drawing? What ex post facto lessons of history? And that crash over the telephone, had that been the beginning, or had Jack simply dropped his eye? I laughed drunkenly, the eruption paining my head. Suddenly the shooting ceased, and in the silence there was the sound of voices, footfalls, labor.
"Hey, buddy,"
somebody said beside me.
"Where you going?"
It was Schofield. "It's either run or get knocked down," I said. I thought you were still back there."
"I cut out, man. A building two doors away started to burn, and I had to get the fire department. Damn, wasn't for this noise, I'd swear those bullets was mosquitoes."
"Watch out," I warned, pulling him away from where a man lay propped against a post, tightening a tourniquet around his gashed arm. Schofield flashed his light, and for a second I saw the black man, his face gray with shock, watching the jetting, pulsing of his blood spurting into the street. Then, compelled, I reached down and twisted the tourniquet, feeling the blood warm upon my hand, seeing the pulsing cease.
"You done stopped it,"
a young man said, looking down. "Here," I said, "you take it, hold it tight, get him to a doctor."
"Ain't you a doctor?"
"Me?" I said. "Me? Are you crazy? If you want him to live, get him away from here."
"I've done gone for one," the boy said, but I thought you was one, you."
"No," I said, looking at my bloody hands. "No, not me. You hold it tight until the doctor comes. I couldn't cure a headache." I stood, wiping my hands against the briefcase, looking down at the big man, his back resting against the post with his eyes closed, the boy holding desperately to the tourniquet made of what had been a bright new tie. "Come on," I said.
"Say," Schofield said when we were past, "wasn't that you that woman was calling brother back yonder?"
"Brother? No, it must have been some other guy."
"You know, man, I think I seen you before somewhere. You ever was in Memphis?" "Say, look what's coming," he said, pointing,
and I looked through the dark to see a squad of white-helmeted policemen charge forward and break for a shelter as a rain of bricks shower down from the building tops. Some of the white helmets racing for the doorways turned to fire, and I heard Schofield grunt and go down, and I dropped beside him, seeing the red burst of fire and hearing the shrill scream like an arching dive curving from above to end in a crunching thud in the street. It was as though it landed in my stomach, sickening me, and I crouched, looking down past Schofield, who lay just ahead of me, to see the dark, crushed form from the roof, and farther away the body of a cop, his helmet making a small, white, luminous mound in the dark. I moved now to see whether Schofield was hit, just as he squirmed around and cursed at the cops who were trying to rescue the one who was down, his voice furious, as he stretched full length, firing away with a nickel-plated pistol like that Dupree had waved.
"Get the hell down, man," he yelled over his shoulder. "I've been wanting to blast him for a long time."
"No, not with that thing," I said. "Let's get out of here."
"Hell, man, I can shoot this thing," he said.
I rolled behind a pile of baskets filled with rotting chickens now, and to my left, upon the littered curb, a woman and a man crouched behind an upturned delivery cart.
"D-Hart," she said, let's get up the hill, D-Hart, up with the respectable people." "Hell, hell, we stay right here," the man said. "This thing's just starting. If it become a show enough race riot, I want to be here, where there'll be some fighting back."
The words struck like bullets fired close range, blasting my satisfaction to earth. It was as though the uttered word had given meaning to the night, almost as though it had created it, brought it into being in the instant his breath vibrated small against the loud, riotous air. And in defining, in giving organization to the fury, it seemed to spin me around, and in my mind I was looking backward over the days since Clifton's death. Could this be the answer? Could this be what the committee had planned? The answer to why they surrendered our influence to Ross? Suddenly I heard the hoarse explosion of a shotgun and looked past Schofield's glinting pistol to the huddled form from the roof. It was suicide. Without guns, it was suicide. And not even the pawn shops here had guns for sale, and yet I knew with a shattering dread that the uproar, which for the moment marked primarily the crash of men against things, against stores, markets, could swiftly become the crash of men against men, and with most of the guns and numbers on the other side. I could see it now, see it clearly and in growing magnitude. It was not suicide, but murder. The committee had planned it. And I had helped. I'd been a tool just at the very moment I had thought myself free by pretending to agree. I had indeed agreed, had made myself responsible for that huddled form, lighted by flame and gunfire in the street, and all the others whom now the night was making ripe for death. The briefcase swung heavy against my leg as I ran, going away, leaving Schofield cursing his lack of bullets behind me, running wildly and swinging the briefcase hard against the head of a dog that leaped at me out of the crowd, sending him yelping away. To my right lay a quiet residential street with trees, and I entered it, going toward 7th Avenue, toward the district, filled now with horror and hatred. They'll pay, I thought, they'll pay! The street lay dead quiet in the light of the lately risen moon. The gunfire thin and, for a moment, distant. The rioting seemed in another world. For a moment I paused beneath a low, thickly leaved tree, looking down the well-kept, doily shadowed walks past the silent houses. It was as though the tenants had vanished, leaving the houses silent with all windows shaded, refugees from a rising flood. Then I heard the single footfalls coming doggedly toward me in the night, an eerie, slapping sound followed by a precise and hallucinated cry.
Time's flying, souls dying, the coming of the Lord draweth nigh.
As though he had run for days, for years. He trotted past where I stood beneath the tree, his bare feet slapping the walk in silence, going for a few feet and then the high, hallucinated cry beginning again. I ran into the avenue where, in the light of a flaming liquor store, I saw three old women scurrying toward me with raised skirts loaded with canned goods.
I can't stop it just yet, but have mercy, Lord, one of them said. Do, Jesus, do, sweet Jesus.
I moved ahead, the fumes of alcohol and burning tar in my nostrils. Down the avenue to my left, a single street lamp still glowed where the long block was intersected on my right by a street, and I could see a crowd rushing a store that faced the intersection, moving in, and a fusillade of canned goods, salami, liverwurst, hogs' heads, and chitterlings belching out to those outside, and a bag of flour bursting white upon them. As now, out of the dark of the intersecting street, two mounted policemen came to a gallop, heaving, huge and heavy-hooved, charging straight into the swarming mass. And I could see the great forward lunge of the horses and the crowd breaking and rolling back like a wave, back and screaming and cursing and some laughing, back and around and out into the avenue, stumbling and pushing as the horses, heads high and bits froth-flecked, went over the curb to land stiff-legged and slide over the cleared walk as upon ice skates and passed, carried by the force of the charge, sideways now, legs stiff, sparks flying to where another crowd looted another store. And my heart tightened as the first crowd swung imperturbably back to their looting with derisive cries, like sandpipers swinging around to glean the shore after a furious wave's recession. Cursing Jack and the Brotherhood, I moved around a steel grill torn from the front of a pawn shop, seeing the troopers galloping back and the riders lifting the horses to charge again, grim and skillful in their white steel helmets, and the charge beginning. This time a man went down and I saw a woman swinging a gleaming frying pan hard against the horse's rump and the horse neighing and beginning to plunge. They'll pay, I thought, they'll pay. They came toward me as I ran, a crowd of men and women carrying cases of beer, cheese, chains of linked sausage, watermelon, sacks of sugar, hams, cornmeal, fuel lamps. If only he could stop right here, 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 before the others came with their guns, I ran. There was no firing now, but when, I thought, how long before it starts?
Get a side of bacon, Joe, a woman called. Get a side of bacon, Joe. Get Wilson's.
Lord, 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 a dark voice called from the dark. I went on, plunged in a sense of painful isolation as I reached 125th Street and started east. A squad of mounted police galloped past. Men with submachine guns were guarding a bank and a large jewelry store. I moved out to the center of the street, running down the trolley rails. The moon was high now, and before me the shattered glass glittered in the street like the water of a flooded river upon the surface of which I ran as in a dream, avoiding by fate alone the distorted objects washed away by the flood. Then suddenly I seemed to sink, sucked under. Ahead of me the body hung, white, naked, and horribly feminine from a lamppost. I felt myself spin around with horror, and it was as though I had turned some nightmarish somersault. I whirled, still moving by reflex, backtracking and stopped, and now there was another, and another, 7, all hanging before a gutted storefront. I stumbled, hearing the cracking of bones underfoot, and I saw a physician's skeleton scattered on the street, the skull rolling away from the backbone as I steadied long enough to notice the unnatural stiffness of those hanging above me. They were mannequins. Dummies, I said aloud. Hairless, bald, and sterilely feminine. And I recalled the boys in the blonde wigs, expecting the relief of laughter, but suddenly was more devastated by the humor than by the horror. But are they unreal, I thought? Are they? What if one, even one, is real? Is Sybil? I hugged my briefcase, backing away, and ran. They moved in a tight-knit order, carrying sticks and clubs, shotguns and rifles, led by Ross the Exhorter, become Ross the Destroyer upon a great black horse. A new Ross of a haughty, vulgar dignity, dressed in the costume of an Abyssinian chieftain, a fur cap upon his head, his arm bearing a shield, a cape made of the skin of some wild animal around his shoulders. A figure more out of a dream than out of Harlem, than out of even this Harlem night, yet real, alive, alarming. "Come away from that stupid looting," he called to a group before a store. "Come join with us to burst in the armory and get guns and ammunition." And hearing his voice, I opened my briefcase and searched for my dark glasses, my Reinhardts, drawing them out only to see the crushed lenses fall to the street. Reinhardt, I thought, Reinhardt. I turned. The police were back there behind me. If shooting started, I'd be caught in the crossfire. I felt in my briefcase, feeling papers, shattered iron, coins, my fingers closing upon Tarp's leg chain, and I slipped it over my knuckles, trying to think. I closed the flap, locking it. A new mood was settling over me as they came on, a larger crowd than Ross had ever drawn. I went calmly forward, holding the heavy case but moving with a certain new sense of self, and with it a feeling almost of relief, almost of a sigh. I knew suddenly what I had to do, knew it even before it shaped itself completely in my mind. Someone called, "Look!" And Ross bent down from the horse, saw me, and flung, of all things, a spear, and I fell forward at the movement of his arm, catching myself upon my hands, as a tumbler would, and heard the shock of it piercing one of the hanging dummies. I stood, my briefcase coming with me.
"Betrayer!"
Ross shouted.
"It's the brother,"
someone said. They moved up around the horse, excited and not quite decided, and I faced him, knowing I was no worse than he, nor any better, and that all the month of illusion and the night of chaos required but a few simple words, a mild, even a meek, muted action to clear the air, to awaken them and me.
"I am no longer their brother," I shouted. "They want a race riot, and I am against it. The more of us who are killed, the better they like—"
"Ignore his lying tongue," Ross shouted. "Hang him up to teach the black people a lesson, and there be no more traitors, no more Uncle Toms. Hang him up there with them blasted dummies."
"But anyone can see it," I shouted. "It's true. I was betrayed by those who I thought were our friends, but they counted on this man, too. They needed this destroyer to do their work. They deserted you so that in your despair you'd follow this man to your destruction. Can't you see it? They want you guilty of your own murder, your own sacrifice. Grab him!" Ross shouted.
3 men stepped forward and I reached up without thinking, actually a desperate oratorical gesture of disagreement and defiance as I shouted, "No!" But my hand struck the spear, and I wrenched it free, gripping it mid-shaft, point forward.
"They want this to happen," I said. "They planned it. They want the mobs to come uptown with machine guns and rifles. They want the streets to flow with blood, your blood, black blood, and white blood, so that they can turn your death and your sorrow and your defeat into propaganda. It's simple. You've known it a long time. It goes, use a nigger to catch a nigger. Well, they used me to catch you, and now they're using Ross to do away with me and to prepare your sacrifice. Don't you see it? Isn't it clear? Hang the lion traitor," Ross shouted. "What are you waiting for?"
I saw a group of men start forward.
"Wait," I said. Then kill me for myself, for my own mistake. Then leave it there. Don't kill me for those who are downtown laughing at the trick they played. But even as I spoke, I knew it was no good. I had no words. I had no eloquence. And when Ross thundered, "Hang him!" I stood there facing them, and it seemed unreal. I faced them knowing that the madman in a foreign costume was real and yet unreal, knowing that he wanted my life, that he held me responsible for all the nights and days and all the suffering and for all that which I was incapable of controlling. And I, no hero, but short and dark, with only a certain eloquence and a bottomless capacity for being a fool to mark me from the rest. Saw them, recognized them at last as those whom I had failed and of whom I was now, just now, a leader, though leading them, running ahead of them, only in the stripping away of my illusionment. I looked at Ross on his horse and at their handful of guns and recognized the absurdity of the whole night and of the simple yet confoundingly complex arrangement of hope and desire, fear and hate that had brought me here still running and knowing now who I was and where I was and knowing too that I had no longer to run for or from the Jacks and the Emersons and the Bledsoes and the Nortons, but only from their confusion, impatience, and refusal to recognize the beautiful absurdity of their American identity and mine. I stood there, knowing that by dying, that by being hanged by Ross on this street in this destructive night, I would perhaps move them one fraction of a bloody step closer to a definition of who they were and of what I was and had been. But the definition would have been too narrow. I was invisible, and hanging would not bring me to visibility, even to their eyes, since they wanted my death not for myself alone, but for the chase I'd been on all my life, because of the way I'd been run, chased, operated, purged. Although, to a great extent, I could have done nothing else, given their blindness. But didn't they tolerate both Reinhardt and Bledsoe, and my invisibility? And that I, a little black man with an assumed name should die because a big black man in his hatred and confusion over the nature of a reality that seemed controlled solely by white men whom I knew to be as blind as he was just too much, too outrageously absurd. And I knew that it was better to live out one's own absurdity than to die for that of others, whether for Ross's or Jack's. So when Ross yelled, "Hang him," I let fly the spear, and it was as though for a moment I had surrendered my life and begun to live again, watching it. "Catch him!" as he turned his head to shout, ripping through both cheeks, and saw the surprised pause of the crowd as Ross wrestled with the spear that locked his jaws. Some of the men raised their guns, but they were too close to shoot, and I hit the first with Tarp's leg chain and the other in the middle with my briefcase, then ran through a looted store, hearing the blanging of the burglar alarm as I scrambled over scattered shoes, upturned showcases, chairs, back to where I saw the moonlight through the rear door ahead. They came behind me like a draft of flames, and I led them through and around and to the avenue, and if they'd fired, they could have had me. But it was important to them that they hang me, lynch me even, since that was the way they ran, had been taught to run. I should die by hanging alone, as though only hanging would settle things, even the score. So I ran, expecting death between the shoulder blades or through the back of my head, and as I ran, I was trying to get to Mary's. It was not a decision of thought, but something I realized suddenly while running over puddles of milk in the black streets, stopping to swing the heavy briefcase and the leg chain slipping and sliding out of their hands. If only I could turn around and drop my arms and say, "Look, men, give me a break. We're all black folks together. Nobody cares." Though now I knew we cared. They at last cared enough to act. So I thought, if only I could say, "Look, they've played a trick on us, the same old trick with new variations. Let's stop running and respect and love one another." If only, I thought, running into another crowd, now thinking I'd gotten away, only to catch a punch on my jaw as one closed in shouting and feeling the leg chain bounce as I caught his head and spurred it forward, turning out of the avenue only to be struck by a spray of water that seemed to descend from above.
It was a mane that had burst, throwing a fierce curtain of spray into the night. I was going for Mary's, but I was moving downtown through the dripping street rather than up, and as I started through, a mounted policeman charged through the spray, the horse black and dripping, charging through and looming, huge and unreal, neighing and clopping across the pavement upon me now as I slipped to my knees and saw the huge, pulsing bulk floating down upon me and over me, the sound of hooves and screams and a rush of water coming through distant as though I sat remote in a padded room, then over, almost past, the hair of the tail, a fiery lash across my eyes. I stumbled about in circles, blindly swinging the briefcase, the image of a fiery comet's tail burning my smarting lids, turning and swinging blindly with briefcase and leg chain and hearing the gallop begin as I floundered helplessly, and now moving straight into the full naked force of the water, feeling its power like a blow, wet and thudding and cold, and through it enabled and partly to see just as another horse dashed up and through, a hunter taking a barrier, the rider slanting backward, the horse rising, then hit and swallowed by the rising spray. I stumbled down the street, the comet tail in my eyes, seeing a little better now, looking back to see the water spraying like a mad geyser in the moonlight. To Mary, I thought, to Mary. There were rows of iron fences backed by low hedges before the houses, and I stumbled behind one and lay panting to rest from the crushing force of the water. But hardly had I settled down, the dry, dog-day smell of the hedge in my nose, when they stopped before the house, leaning upon the fence. They were passing a bottle around, and their voices sounded spent of strong emotions.
"This is some night," one of them said. "Ain't this some night?"
"Is about like the rest."
"Why you say that?"
"'Cause it's full of fucking and fighting and drinking and lying. Give me that bottle."
"Yeah, but tonight I seen some things I never seen before."
"You think you seen something? Hell, you ought to have been over on Lennox about 2 hours ago. You know that stud Roster destroyer? Well, man, he was spitting blood."
"That crazy guy?"
"Hell, yes, man. He had him a big black horse and a fur cap and some kind of old lion skin or something over his shoulders, and he was raising hell. God damn if he wasn't a sight, riding up and down on this old horse, you know. One of the kind that pulls vegetable wagons. And he got him a cowboy saddle and some big spurs."
"Oh, no, man."
"Hell, yes. Riding up and down the block yelling, 'Destroy him. Drive him out. Burn him out. Ah, Ross commands you.' 'You get that man,' he said. 'Ah, Ross commands you. You destroy them to the last piece of rotten fish.' And about that time, some joker with a big old Georgia voice sticks his head out the window and yells, 'Ride 'em, cowboy! Give 'em hell and bananas!' And the man, that crazy son of a bitch, up there on that horse looked like death eating a sandwich. He reaches down and comes up with a .45 and starts blazing up at that window. And man, talk about cutting out. Ooh! In the second, wasn't nobody left but old Ross up there on that horse with that lion skin stretched straight out behind him. Crazy, man. Everybody else trying to get some loot and him and his boys out for blood." I lay like a man rescued from drowning, listening, still not sure I was alive.
"I was over there,"
another voice said.
"You see him when the mounted police got after his ass?"
"Hell no. Here, take a little taste."
"Well, that's when you should have seen him. When he seen them cops riding up, he reached back of his saddle and come up with some kind of old shield."
"A shield?"
"Hell yes. One with a spike in the middle of it. And that ain't all. I mean, when he sees the cops, he calls one of his goddamn henchmen to hand him up a spear, and a little short guy run out into the street, and he give him one. You know, one of the kind you see them African guys carrying in the moving pictures?"
"Where the hell was you, man?"
"Me? I'm over on the side where some stud done broke into a stall and is selling cold beer." "Out the window. Done gone into business, man."
The voice laughed. "I was drinking me some Budweiser and digging the doings when here come the cops up the street riding like cowboys, man." "And when old Rossin, what's his name, sees him and lets out a roar like a lion and rears way back and starts shooting spurs in that horse's ass just as fast as nickels falling in the subway at going home time." Goddamn, that's when you ought to see him. "Say, give me a taste of that there, fella."
"Thanks." "He comes, boogity-boogity, with that spear stuck out in front of him and that shield on his arm charging me. And he's yelling something in African or West Indian or something. And he's got his head down low, like he knew about that shit too, man. He riding like Earl Sand in the Fifth at Jamaica. That old black horse let out a whinny and got his head down. I don't know where he got that son of a bitch. But gentlemen, I swear, when he felt that steel in his high behind, he came on like man of war going to get his ashes hauled. Before the cops knowed what hit him, Ross is right in the middle of him. And one cop ran for that spear. And old Ross swung around and bust him across his head. And the cop goes down and his horse rears up. And old Ross rears his and tries to spear him another cop. And the other horse is just plunging around. And old Ross tries to spear him still another cop. Only he's too close. And the horse is pooting and snorting and pissing and shitting. And it swings around, and the cop is swinging his pistol, and every time he swings it, old Ross throws up his shield with one arm and chops at him with the spear with the other. And man, you could hear that gun striking that old shield like somebody dropping tire irons out a 12-story window. And you know what? When old Ross